KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Pan-African Film Series hosted by the All African People's Revolutionary Party. The film this month is The Fall of Libya, showing Wednesday, February 24th at 6 p.m. at the Portland State University Smith Memorial Student Union in Room 329. The Fall of Libya is a short documentary of the role of imperialism played violently and illegally overthrowing the democratically elected Libyan government in 2011. Again, that's The Fall of Libya, Wednesday, February 24th at 6 p.m. at the Smith Memorial Student Union in Room 329 at Portland State University, 1825 Southwest Broadway in Portland. Again, that is 1825 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host this February 22nd Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick talks with Frank Ackerman on the costs of curbing climate change to manageable levels versus the cost of continuing on the current path. Frank Ackerman is an economist who has written extensively about the economics of climate change, energy, and other environmental problems. His book, Priceless, on Knowing the Price of Everything and the Value of Nothing, is a critique of cost-benefit analysis and its abuse in the U.S. environmental policy. Jan Hawken interviews Tracy Francis, coordinator of the Cascade Festival of African Films. That's at PCC, free and open to the public. The festival runs through the first week of March. They discuss some of the history of the festival, upcoming films and events, and the contributions of African women filmmakers featured in the final week of the festival. More information on that is at www.africanfilmfestival.org. In the second half of our program, I will consider the likelihood that Michelle Alexander, professor of law at Ohio State University and author of the book New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, could be our next Supreme Court justice. And to conclude today's show, I'll team with Jan Hawken as we unpack the Beyoncé controversy, digging into the media and culture critic response to the Queen Bee's new release, Formation, the video, Super Bowl performance, and the politics of race in popular music. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting KBOO and programs like the Old Mole Variety Hour. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, we turn to Bill Resnick and Frank Ackerman.
Hi, Frank Ackerman. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Frank Ackerman is an economist who came to specialize in environmental issues. His latest books include Can We Afford the Future? Economics for a Warming World, and also Priceless, on Knowing the Price of Everything and the Value of Nothing. Frank Ackerman forces opposing replacement of fossil fuels with renewable energy. They warn workers, and indeed all Americans, that renewable energy, like wind turbines and solar panels, they'll be very costly, they'll be very unreliable, and they will greatly increase unemployment. And the labor movement has been reluctant to support the energy revolution because many of its member unions support the companies they work for. People are desperate to have a decent job nowadays in America and very insecure. Your research firm has studied what actually is likely to occur with the determined move to renewables combined with a determined effort at energy efficiency and conservation. And that study is titled The Clean Energy Future. It's on the website of the Labor Network for Sustainability. Frank Ackerman, tell us why it's so important, first, to speed up the energy revolution and what your studies revealed.
So we face several conflicting demands, all of which seem urgent. On the one hand, the reduction of carbon emissions, the understanding of climate change, which grows more detailed and more ominous year by year, shows that we have to begin now reducing emissions, and reducing the emissions from the U.S. energy system is definitely one of the places to start. On the other hand, we have many people who are not able to pay large cost increases, and we have a widespread belief that people at any income level will not accept new taxes, new costs imposed on them to solve problems like this. And there is a concern about jobs. Will doing new things for the environment throw people out of work? Can we create jobs in larger numbers than they're lost? So we set out to see whether all three objectives could be met at once: sharp reduction in carbon emissions, no new net cost increases for the energy system, and no net job loss. And what we found is that, yes, you can describe a system that achieves all three of these at once. You can describe a system that slashes the emissions from electricity and transportation in the U.S., the two principal sources of energy emissions, costing about the same as the business-as-usual, do-nothing-new scenario. Energy isn't free at present, and for the same price that we're spending on energy, we could, instead of sticking with the system we have, we could switch to one which is almost entirely renewables. And in that process, it would create an average of over 500,000 net new jobs every year, most of them in construction and manufacturing. Clean energy is a very blue-collar intensive activity. It creates more industrial jobs than almost any other proposal that you can see. So our report describes what it takes to do all three of those at once.
As I read your graphs, you start with a great deal of energy conservation at the beginning as you're building up your renewable energy production facilities.
That's right. The cheapest way to reduce the use of fossil fuels is to conserve energy, to deliver the same energy services, the same level of comfort, convenience, transportation with less energy. There are many, many opportunities to do that. They're generally quite cheap. Insulating low-income housing is a classic example. Replacing light bulbs, anyone still has any of those old incandescent light bulbs around, replacing them with, well, now you can put in LEDs, which are even better than the compact fluorescents. Those sorts of measures, and there are many more such measures, are the first step, the cleanest and simplest step. There's also, in addition to construction jobs that are created, installing insulation, for instance, installing energy efficiency measures. The next step after that will be installing renewable energy, wind power and solar power, and building the wind turbines, building the solar panels that get installed.
Which will create a tremendous number of jobs.
That's right.
And then
each of these steps creates jobs. Energy efficiency actually creates jobs, installing energy efficiency measures. Building and then installing wind power and solar power creates a lot of jobs. And we found that to reach the kind of carbon reduction targets that people in the climate world are talking about, that we had to project a replacement of most cars and light trucks with electric vehicles, and most space heating and water heating with electric heating, powering all of those with a further expansion of renewable energy for electricity. So in place of gasoline, in place of heating oil or natural gas for heating, we would again have an increased use of renewable energy.
I assume that, at least at the time span in which you're doing it, you would be replacing basically coal and then gas-powered electricity production as, in fact, those plants age and become really costly to repair and then would just have to be closed down. So you're replacing those supplies of energy with renewables. That's probably the cheapest way over the long run, it seems to me, and that's what I think your plan suggests.
Right. So our plan looks at the period from 2015 to 2050, the 35-year span to mid-century. And in that period, we assume that every coal plant will be eliminated, starting with the oldest and most expensive ones, but they will all be gone by some point in the 2040s. We assume that nuclear plants live out their 60-year lifetime from when they were built and then are retired. We assume no new nuclear plants will be built. That means that by 2050, almost every nuclear plant in the country will be gone. The last few will be gone shortly after 2050. So that this is not a scenario of relying on nuclear power. It's not a scenario of relying on coal because we're phasing out coal. It does use some natural gas to balance the system, to fill in the gaps in the system, but it uses less natural gas than the business as usual scenario, so that we are reducing, not increasing, the use of natural gas. We're not fully phasing it out by 2050. We don't think that that's quite in the realm of economic feasibility yet to meet our standards of no new cost increase.
Although if, it seems to me if storage technology makes a breakthrough and it becomes a whole lot easier, you would need no natural gas at all, is my understanding.
Right. You're exactly right. That is the technological breakthrough that is needed to make it possible to fully get off of natural gas. If storage becomes technologically feasible and affordable as an alternative, then you can build even more renewable energy, store the energy when the sun is shining and the wind is blowing, and have it available at other times. There already are some storage opportunities. There are systems that use air conditioning systems or water heaters to provide a form of storage. For instance, there are more and more systems that use the air conditioning compressor to make ice at night and then use the ice during the daytime to lower the requirements for air conditioning. You can run a system off peak in the middle of the night, create ice, and cool the buildings down during the peak hours when electricity is more expensive. There are a lot of interesting experiments like that, and if that line of research leads to a breakthrough, that's the time that we can fully get off of natural gas as well.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole on KBOO. I'm talking to Frank Ackerman. He's an economist in Boston. He's an environmental economist and has studying the feasibility of going to close to 100% renewable energy, and has found that, in fact, it doesn't cost jobs. You gain a great deal of jobs, and it will not, in fact, increase people's bills. It's perfectly feasible. Frank Ackerman, your timeline was at 35 years up to 2050. I wonder, what would the picture be if we decided to mobilize all of our resources and go to renewable energy very, very quickly, let's say in the next 15 or 20 years? It would require an enormous mobilization, although apparently people who've done the studies see those only, whatever, 3 to 5 to 6% of, quote, GDP, of productive capacity, would be necessary. What would be the additional cost of moving up the date so quickly, which would then enormously reduce the risks of really catastrophic global warming becoming completely unmanageable and leaving the planet basically uninhabitable, that is for civilizations our size, for sure? Why not do it more quickly?
Well, Bill, I think you've pointed to a very real but also very uncertain risk, that every year that we don't reduce emissions is another year in which we are at risk of more disruption of the climate system, more risk of some of these irreversible tipping points at which we start to lose natural functions. So yes, that's a real risk. In terms of our study, what we set out to do was not to describe the maximum, but to describe the minimum that anyone should do. Our study is defined as how far you can move in this direction for no net cost increase. That's not to say that no net cost increase is the ideal policy. It's quite possible we should spend money to go faster. Our point was just, this is a floor. There's no sense in thinking about doing less than this because this much is free and it has very desirable properties. Yes, I think there's a very good case to be made for going faster. I can't tell you exactly how much faster. The faster you go, the more you're retiring existing plants that still had some economic value. The sooner you retire them, the more you lose in that way, the more expensive it is to replace something before the end of its lifetime. It's as simple as that. So the faster we go, should coal plants be retired before the end of their lifetime? Some of them actually are at the end of their lifetime. Should nuclear plants be replaced before the end of their lifetime? Very good case can be made for those things, but we are now talking about net cost increases. So we have to be conscious of that. I think it's a very interesting problem about how you think about it. Uncertainty, how much do you pay to insure society, to insure the world against these kind of catastrophic risks? But that's not something that we can pin a precise number on.
This is KBOO Radio, Bill Resnick talking to Frank Ackerman about climate change and how it the risk of really catastrophic climate change can be reduced. Frank Ackerman, let me state a hypothesis for you. My sense is that, out of the readings I've done, is that the cities of the planet are enlarging, urbanization is continuing, and right now more than half of humans live in huge metropolitan areas. I mean, that's part one part. The other part is that it's those areas that drive the rape of the countryside. That is, it's the demands of the cities, which are richer than the countryside and have more demands and have to import all sorts of stuff. But it's the demands of the cities that create something like, I read, 70% of the sort of the greenhouse gases that are now flowing into the atmosphere can be traced to city life and the way we live in cities. Now, if that's true, it seems to me then that the cities, reconstructing the cities, becomes a very high priority. Does that hypothesis make sense?
It certainly is true that half the world's population and more than half of the world's income lives in cities now, so that the demand for goods comes from cities. I'm not sure that I would describe city dwellers wanting to eat food that was grown in rural areas as the rape of the countryside. I think that's the way that food production is organized. I don't think that the problem can be solved within the city limits, however. The question of food production is a classic. There's no way a big city can produce its food within its city limits. So reorganizing the way in which people in cities use resources from the countryside is a reorganization that involves all of us, not just how the city is run. People may feel that their city government is more accessible, that it's a better lever of change, a lever of power than a more remote election, but we are talking about problems that span more than a single city. We're talking about a system which we are all part of and how that system needs to change.
Yeah, I think that's true. The additional argument is that the cities are much more ready to accept and live on basically public goods and public resources, and they share them in common, like parks and like transit and like schools. It's harder to sort of be autarkic in the cities. You can't have a good life in the cities without, you know, New York City as the sort of the apotheosis of that. It's the public places that make it great, and the apartments are all quite small, even for relatively rich people. So the cities are much more friendly to public investments and public goods. And therefore, those cities, they vote much more liberally, and they are ready to accept, it seems to me, higher rates of taxes and contributions for decent public goods, which means that the cities are the places where we can model all of the changes that have to be made. What do you make of that argument?
I don't think autarky is a believable strategy for anybody in the country or city. If you happen to live in some place that can grow a lot of its own food, are you also producing your own automobiles, your own telephones, your own medical supplies? I think obviously not. I think we are all at this point in history dependent on a flow of resources from one place to another, from one city to another, between city and countryside. And looking within a small circle makes sense only as a strategy for where to start changing things.
I think that's what I was referring to. Obviously, you have to have a sort of synergy between the city and the countryside.
But so we absolutely have to change the way that transportation is organized and powered. We have to stop using gasoline-powered, diesel-powered vehicles. Most places are not going to produce vehicles. Some places will, most places will not, but we all have to be part of a system of changing the way that vehicles are produced and vehicles are powered. So I think that that's as true for the countryside as for the cities.
I agree with that. I think the point I was trying to make is not to have a city that's autarkic and trying to live within its own means and production. It's not going to work. But as the city changes, and since it's the center of populations of the world, the way leadership are chosen is going to depend on the wills of the people in the city and any kind of even the very thin democracy that we live in. And then that political leadership will be making changes that extend to the countryside. I think the argument is that cities are really an important place to begin that. It's not the end all, but to begin that energy revolution. And the countryside, of course, is important as well.
I think the energy revolution that we need requires innovation and experimentation on a number of levels. There are things that people can do locally, solar panels on rooftops, many energy efficiency measures can be done right where you are and can be done more efficiently by you and your household, by a contractor you hire, than by a large institution. There's no doubt about that. Other things that are vital to the transition we need, from wind turbines, which today are much too big for a household or even a small municipality, to the potential for some of the lowest cost solar innovations, maybe too large for a household, to the whole question of the transformation of vehicles, of our transport system to being one that can be run on renewable energy, things like that that we all have to be part of, something very large. So that this will happen at many scales. There's a vital scale that can be done at your household, at your local community level, and there are equally vital parts in which we have to be part of the larger picture. Being part of a country in which one political party has been captured by the idea that climate change isn't real and that we can reject any measures to do anything about it, that's the problem of the transition right now. We have to find a way to get America back on track to participating in the world process of reducing emissions, which the Supreme Court has come dangerously close to throwing out.
That's not the way I was hoping to end, but Frank Ackerman, thank you for enlightening us. It was really interesting. And the struggle will continue. My sense is that the people will wake up soon.
I think people are waking up to this. I don't think that the dreadful politics of this year will prevail. I think that we will see better political leadership and a continuation of the energy transition that we've seen. What was so encouraging about this last climate conference was the beginnings of a sign that the U.S. and China and other major countries were all talking together about joint reduction in emissions, not yet promising enough, but taking a first step together, which is much more than has been done before. I think we can get back on track to getting America to take the lead in that process as it should.
The problem is they aren't ready to review it for 5 years, which it seems to me speaks more than any agreement. It's like just a recipe for delay, and not doing anything.
It's a flawed agreement. There's no question about it that much better ones could have been written. I think the fact that they got so many countries together around the idea of doing something is hopeful. If they don't come together and agree to do more in the future, it won't be nearly enough. It's a timid step in the right direction instead of continuing to take steps in the wrong direction. But we now have to figure out how to take a much bolder step in the right direction.
Frank Ackerman, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Sure, my pleasure.
And folks, if you want to look at the report from Synnex firm, Frank Ackerman's principal investigator, you can find The Clean Energy Future, that's the name of it, Protecting the Climate, Creating Jobs and Saving Money. It's on the website at the Labor Network for Sustainability.
Is Black Uhuru, The World is Africa. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO, Portland 90.7 FM. Later on the Old Mole, I'll look at a recent article by Michelle Alexander discussing the political history of Hillary Clinton and the problem of black voters supporting the Clintons given their history around incarceration. And as many of you know, Michelle Alexander has written extensively on mass incarceration. And we'll close the program today with a discussion of the Beyoncé controversy. Yes, the Old Mole has strayed away from digging deep into popular culture, so we're bringing that back this morning. Next up, we have Jan Hocken and Tracy Francis, who's the coordinator of the Cascade Festival of African Films. They're going to be talking about the African Film Festival at PCC, free and open to the public. Jan?
And we'll also be joined by Tara Foster, the previous coordinator of the festival and current member of the executive committee. Welcome to KBOO, Tracy Francis and Tara Foster.
Thank you.
So, Tara, why don't we start... So Tara's not on the line yet. So, Tracy, let's start with you and tell us a little about the history of the Cascade Festival of African Films. It's been... at the Portland Community College campus in Northeast Portland for many years now.
Yes, so we are entering our 26th year right now, and we are mostly at PCC Cascade, and we have a couple of films every year at the Hollywood Theater as well.
And it goes for...
5 weeks.
5 weeks, Thursday through Saturday. That's quite a show to keep going.
Yeah, so we have two more weeks left of the festival this year. And then this week we have visiting director Yared Zaliki coming. Okay.
So, Tara Foster, welcome to KBOO as well. You're here by phone. So, can you tell us some about the aims of the festival, what you try to do politically and culturally through the festival?
Well, we want to bring more about Africa to the Portland area. Many people obviously can't travel as much as they would like to, and we feel that there's so much to learn from this continent that seems so far away, but really isn't. It's kind of a small world. So we use cinema, it's such an important medium, to open that window for film viewers in the Portland area.
And as I understand it, one aim is to correct the myopic and distorted lens on the continent of Africa through the Hollywood, as they say, cinematic gaze.
Right. We actually are so focused on getting an African view, an African lens, instead of the Western view, the Western lens, which we do see through Hollywood films and non-African filmmakers so often. There's so much more about Africa to learn from people who live there and who have been born there and who have lived there their whole lives.
And just one glance through the film scheduled to screen over the more than a month of the festival, one gets a sense of the rich complexity and the dynamic diversity of the films themselves coming from many regions and countries of Africa. Can you tell us a little bit about what's coming up this week? As I understand it, there's the director of LAM, a very interesting Ethiopian film will be here. Is that correct?
Absolutely. This week we've got the director of LAM. We're going to be showing that in matinee on Thursday the 25th, and then on Friday the 26th that will be seen in the evening. We've partnered with the Queer Resource Center at PCC Cascade to show Stories of Our Lives, which is an amazing Kenyan film, which has been produced by a collective about LGBTQ issues in Kenya, which, as many people know, those folks are criminalized and ostracized there, and we wanted to show their stories. It's an amazing film. And then we've got Documentary Night, which all of our documentary nights this year are focused on arts and culture and music. We're showing Les Petites Chattes, which I'm sure Tracy can tell you quite a bit more about.
Yeah, Tracy, tell us about that film.
So that film is about a very famous Egyptian cover band in the 60s and 70s that my uncle actually sang in.
Small world.
And so the film kind of follows the rise and kind of comeback of the band and looking also at the cultural changes in Egypt between the 60s and the present day.
So that's a convention in many films is using the rise and sometimes the fall of the musicians to chart a broader political course of a society. Is it political in that sense? How it's situated?
Somewhat. I mean, the filmmaker does show, you know, because the Egyptian culture has shifted quite dramatically since the 60s to today and has gone through, you know, different wars and conflicts and coups and different things. And so it's showing how the band's music and the culture has responded to that, how the band's popularity kind of fall and, you know, rise and fall in accordance with how the cultural shifts have happened in Egypt.
Including the Arab Spring?
Including the Arab Spring, yeah. They kind of had a comeback in the last few years. They're all old fellows now, but recently they've been having bigger concerts. They had a concert a couple weeks ago at the Cairo Opera House that sold out in 2 hours. It's showing that now people are kind of wanting that nostalgia, wanting that kind of that fun again, which is nice to see.
Yeah, music plays such an important part in social movements in that sense. So there can be nostalgia in the conservative sense for an old world that becomes romanticized, but also as a way of holding on to periods of hope that have been dashed or repressed.
Exactly, and find that hope again, too. Yeah.
So one of my favorite, if not my favorite part of film festivals, is the post-screening discussion. Can you tell us about the discussions at the festivals and what happens there? Sometimes the directors are there, sometimes not.
Yeah, well, so Saturday night, the director couldn't be there, but he did Skype in. And so we had a lovely conversation with him on Skype, which was really fun. And of course, this week we'll have Yared here in person to talk after Lamb and to answer audience's questions. And what I've loved about the after film discussions is they usually go quite deep and people ask really compelling questions. And there's usually a great discussion afterward of real topics and real issues.
And sometimes the films are either sponsored or supported by local community groups to also bridge some of the distance in the world and establish bonds of solidarity. Can you tell us about Stories of Our Lives? And Tara was talking a bit earlier about what the film was about. Tell us more about that film and how you're working with local activists around it.
Sure. So as Tara said, we're partnering with the PCC Queer Resource Center, who is bringing in several after film speakers. We'll have a short panel after both the matinee and the evening performance to kind of have a discussion around that. And one of our after film speakers is a Somalian man who came out in the U.S. and is an activist here. And so he'll be talking about his experiences. And the film itself was created by a collective in Kenya that went around and just collected stories to start with. People with LGBTQ community, and they decided the best way to tell those stories was through film.
And there was some struggle about how visible to be or how to represent the participants or subjects in the film. Do you know anything about that process?
Yes. Yeah, so the stories themselves, the people that told stories, they kept that anonymous, of course. But originally, the filmmakers themselves were anonymous. But they decided that since the actors were brave enough to show themselves on screen and to be visible in that way, that they also should, you know, reveal their identities and be visible as well, and to take that risk and be active in that sense.
There's a heroic tradition of filmmaking and forms of coming out that are not always recognized in film culture, particularly small independent or guerrilla film projects. And this apparently has not screened in Kenya, is that right, publicly?
No.
Yeah. So this will be an important work to honor.
Yes, definitely.
And to learn more about. And just in closing, can you... Tara, can you say a little about how people come and how they can contribute to supporting the festival over time?
Absolutely.
Because there must be resources involved. Free and open to the public. How do you sustain yourselves?
Volunteers.
So we have the most amazing sponsors and contributors. And PCC is one of our largest sponsors. But we also have really great sponsors like other local universities and like Hollywood Theater, Providence Health Services. We have smaller sponsors like Kofalan Cultural Center and Senegalese Association of Portland and Southwest Washington. If you go to our website, you can see a list of all of our amazing sponsors. I wish I had time to list them all, but I just don't. PSU sponsored our centerpiece film on Friday night, and then we thank them very much for that, the Black Studies Department. This coming Saturday afternoon, we're going to have a family film, which I failed to mention earlier, so I wanted to mention that.
Yeah, that's one of the themes. That's, I think, a unique aspect of the festival is different themes, nights, women's shorts for a week, documentaries, family. So what happens on Family Day?
On Family Film Day, Babalwage Jakite, a local artist and writer, comes in and does an oral storytelling, which is just fantastic. And we have a free children's raffle where they can win films or books which have been donated by local sponsors. And we have we then show a film, and it's just packed. We show it at Moriarty, room 104 at PCC Cascade. And, you know, sometimes it gets a little noisy, but nobody really seems to care because there's kids there of every age. There's coloring opportunities for the kids out in the hallway, and we really just have a good time on Family Film Day. People often drop donations at the door. We're very thankful for that. They can buy raffle tickets for really fantastic items. The World Affairs Council of Oregon sends us speaker series tickets every year to give away in our raffle. We have beautiful platters and pottery from local organizations and artists.
So the creativity of the festival spills out off the screen into the room and area. So just in closing, we can find out about the festival through your website. Tracy, do you want to let people know how they can look at the schedule and the films?
Yeah, on AfricanFilmFestival.org, we have our calendar. We have trailers of all the films. You can even donate on there to help the festival keep going, and join our mailing list as the best way also to keep abreast of what's going on in the festival.
Uh-huh. And it's a wonderful way to celebrate Black History Month as well.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yes.
So this is Jan Hawken talking today with Tracy Francis, coordinator of the Cascade Festival of African Films, and Tara Foster, previous coordinator, about the festival, which is now ongoing through the first week of March at the Cascade Portland Community College campus. And it's free and open to the public. Can't get better than that.
Thanks, Jan.
Thank you.
Hey now, is my mic still on? It's on. And this song is called Backlash.
That's Nina Simone with Mr. Backlash, always a good go-to in these times. This is Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I want to take a little look at some activity on the part of Michelle Alexander, really well known for her writing on mass incarceration in the U.S. And recently, she published an article in The Nation that is quite long. I'm going to highlight some of that this morning, but I recommend folks take a look at it. It's very good. So if you think Beyonce stirred the pot with her new song and video formation and her Super Bowl performance, let's see President Obama take up the call for him to nominate Ohio State University law professor, scholar, and activist Michelle Alexander for the newly vacant seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. An online petition of several thousand calling for Alexander's nomination may not constitute a movement, but it sure is interesting to consider. The petition states, quote, "The Supreme Court needs a jurist with a strong background in criminal law," and calls Alexander's analysis of the law very fair, thorough, and impressive. Her credentials? Law degree from Stanford Law School, check. Former director of the Racial Justice Project at the ACLU of Northern California, check. Director of the Civil Rights Clinic at Stanford Law and a law clerk for Justice Harry Blackmun at the U.S. Supreme Court, check. Specialized in plaintiff-side class action suits alleging race and gender discrimination and litigated numerous class action discrimination cases and worked on criminal justice reform issues. So, that sounds pretty good to me. But I think Michelle Alexander, our outspoken critic of America's corporate, America's corrupt justice system and author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, doesn't seem to be grooming herself for a tooth and nail quest for that open seat. Rather, she's been busy trying to sway the black vote away from Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party establishment. Alexander has been calling out Clinton for her connection to mass incarceration via her strong advocacy of her husband's 1994 crime bill. What did this bill look like? Quote, "The bill created dozens of new federal capital crimes, mandated life sentences for some three-time offenders, and authorized more than $16 billion for state prison grants and expansion of the state and local police forces. Clinton escalated the drug war beyond what conservatives had imagined possible a decade earlier. The Clinton administration's tough-on-crime policies resulted in the largest increases in federal and state prison inmates of any president in American history." Back in January, Michelle Alexander wrote, quote, "If anyone doubts that the mainstream media fails to tell the truth about our political system and its true winners and losers, the spectacle of large majorities of black folks supporting Hillary Clinton in the primary races ought to be proof enough. I can't believe Hillary would be coasting into the primaries with her current margin of black support if most people knew how much damage the Clintons have done. The millions of families that were destroyed the last time they were in the White House, thanks to their boastful embrace of the mass incarceration machine and their total capitulation to the right-wing narrative on race, crime, welfare, and taxes. There's so much more to say on this topic, and it's a shame that more people aren't saying it. I think it's time we have that conversation." Well, the conversation does continue in Alexander's February 10th article in The Nation, Why Hillary Clinton Doesn't Deserve the Black Vote, From the Crime Bill to Welfare Reform, Policies Bill Clinton Enacted and Hillary Clinton Supported, Decimated Black America. And Alexander doesn't pull any punches here, questioning the love affair between black people, politicians and pastors included, and the Clintons, saying, quote, "The Clintons are making themselves comfortably at home once again, engaging effortlessly in all the usual rituals associated with courting the black vote. A pursuit that typically begins and ends with Democratic politicians making black people feel liked and taken seriously. Doing something concrete to improve the conditions under which most black people live is generally not required." Well, both Clintons now express regret over the crime bill, and Hillary says she supports criminal justice reforms to undo some of the damage that was done by her husband's administration. But on the campaign trail, she continues to invoke the economy and country that Bill Clinton left behind as a legacy she would continue. Taking a hard look at this recent past is about more than just a choice between two candidates. It's about whether the Democratic Party can finally reckon with what its policies have done to African American communities and whether it can redeem itself and rightly earn the loyalty of black voters. That's Michelle Alexander. But nonetheless, Alexander doesn't seem too enamored with the Democratic Party, titling a recent online post, "If a political revolution is born, it will have little to do with Bernie or Hillary, but everything to do with us." So whatever Supreme Court, we don't need that. We have some real work to do. This is Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
More action. More excitement. More everything.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Across space.
Step right up and step off the train.
The land before time.
Welcome to America.
All the freaks are here.
All you have to do is make a promise.
That's a little taste of Erykah Badu with her American Promise, a great song. Erykah Badu is a great musician, but we're not here to talk about Erykah Badu, who was also a narrator of the Black Power mixtapes, by the way. So musicians can cross that line. But this is Denise Morris. I'm here with Jan Hocken this morning. And Jan, we are going to do it. We're going to talk about the Beyonce controversy on the Old Mole. So it's Black History Month. And what a better way to celebrate the 50-year anniversary of the founding of the Black Panther Party in Oakland than a wildly controversial halftime performance by Beyonce at the 50th Super Bowl.
In San Francisco.
In San Francisco.
For those like me who didn't follow it in detail until you asked me to do this.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, initially my thought was, you know, there are these sacred spaces like Super Bowls and Academy Awards, and there's no politics allowed. And yet they're rife with politics. And so the hypocrisy is beyond belief. But there's much more here to dig into. And you know, Beyonce has been at the center of controversy throughout her career for all sorts of reasons, and even to the extent that she was once called a terrorist by feminist scholar Bell Hooks. Well, that set off its own little controversy.
Inflammatory way of dismissing her. She put that woman in her place.
Right. So yeah. Beyonce drops, as they say, her new song Formation and the video the day before the Super Bowl, and the controversies set fire at that point. But really, I think the best thing about this for folks like us who are maybe outside of this a little bit, full disclosure, I'm not really a Beyonce fan. I'm not a non-fan, but I haven't really gone there. But I know more probably about her pop culture worldliness than I do about her music. And there's so much material out there to mine around this issue. And we did. I'm blurry from all the mining I've done, but we're going to try to unpack it.
It's an interesting era because feminist film criticism, which was a thriving discipline, emerging and still thriving discipline in the 1970s, was very critical of popular culture and Hollywood or classical film, particularly because of its kind of hypnotic way of capturing you, and you didn't know really how it had its way with you until later, you know, reflecting on it. But now, in the digital era, you can replay images, you know, and there's quite a democratizing of film criticism, as it used to be kind of a intellectually very rarefied world. Even psychoanalytic film criticism, it's not an easy read, that work. But now there's a rich, I think, and lively world of film critics that are through blog sites and other online essays. And you know, Bell Hooks, in all fairness, I thought it was a little hyperbolic calling Beyonce a terrorist. She thought she had an enormously destructive effect on young girls. But in all fairness, Bell Hooks has written some of the most important works in film criticism, talked about the oppositional gaze and how the history of film, Hollywood films and television, Black audiences, particularly Black women, have had learned how to develop what she called an oppositional gaze, how to look at films, make use of them in different ways than how they're delivered. She talks about her family watching Amos and Andy, an outrageously racist television series and laughing sympathetically with Sapphire, who is the aggressive, mother figure, and feeling her pain. And so there is, and some of the oppositional gaze is also brought to discussion of Beyoncé and a tremendous ambivalence and kind of complex commentary, kind of unpacking the lyrics and the images. And I think that is really something to note, apart from herself and what her work says from her own standpoint.
Yeah, I like what you've said about the nature of modern technology and media now, because you can watch something over and over again. And I feel like I have gone the rounds with this, from love to hate to love to guilty pleasure to all around it, because there's a lot going on, and there's a lot of complex and contradictory messages and imagery in this. And one of the things that comes up...
And people
up,
are picking up on that, mm-hmm. I think, very much in the commentary.
Yeah.
And not all, you can set aside right away Giuliani and the conservatives' rejection of her as typical and not very interesting. But more interesting is the complexity and ambivalence among many Black cultural critics to her work.
Right. And that's why it's been so great to read so much different material. And I feel like, and my sense is, even though you don't always know where someone is from if they don't disclose that, but the Southerners are coming out with some very wonderful and lyrically poetic writing about this piece and how important it is to them, while many times acknowledging that there's that ambivalence there and the tensions around the kind of the glamour, the wealth,
the commodification of trauma, of Black trauma.
Yeah.
And is she commodifying and kind of writing this stuff and
right.
exploiting? Does she have the right to talk about
right.
the Hurricane Katrina and the trauma mm-hmm. of New Orleans after the floods?
And where is she positioned when, or what is she trying to say when she's talking about wearing her Givenchy dress and dripping with the jewels? And is that a sort of throw in your face, like the lockout for Blacks in America as a result of racism is economic as much as anything. So I find it sometimes interesting or difficult to sort out what is the importance or what is the message around putting the means to do something at the forefront. Now, this is a person who's a millionaire, billionaire probably, but just having the means to say, you can try to mess with me, but I have the means for you to not mess with me.
Yeah,
and I think, what I mean?
Yes, and there are criticisms of that. Benji Hart, who's an activist and queer artist, she's decisively not ambivalent in her mm-hmm. criticism of formation, the imagery in the song and the video. She's Beyoncé is a logo. Beyoncé is a commodity. Beyoncé is a production. Beyoncé is a distraction. Beyoncé mm-hmm. is a ruse. Beyoncé does not actually exist. And I think that last point is very interesting, because in a way, she is like a Rorschach card, where people project all kinds of things on her. And that's her power, is to evoke mm-hmm. and embody the craziness of American culture, as well as aspirational values. And some say her aspirational values have to do with being celebrating capitalism and commodity culture and having so much money and power that no one can touch you.
Right. And being a star.
Being a superstar. But, it is different than I grew up with teen idols and the star system in Hollywood, which inspired devotion. You see a lot of that in sports, this kind of real childlike devotion. We love you when you're winning. We hate you when you're losing. But with this, it is far more complicated, the responses to her and people sensing she embodies something about capitalism that's perverse, but also dazzling and exciting in a way. But I think there is a critique in the same way there is with hip hop, and,
right.
and all of the kind of capitalism and drag.
Yeah, that's true. And there is also the response. Many people have probably taken a look at this, the Saturday Night Live skit where white people discover that Beyoncé is black. While that's really funny, there is something to be said for the problems that occur when a black athlete or celebrity or musician speak out when they maybe haven't. Or maybe they have, but they've publicly said, look, I'm going to cross this line. The punishments are very severe, and I think of
Nina
Simone.
Disrupting a kind of pleasure.
Right, exactly. That and that there's a place for politics
have.
And there's not,
right.
a, you know, like, is really the NBA is a sacred space where there's no racism? That's crazy, you know, and the same with music and with everything. If you're a crafted entity that is pieced together to generate money for lots of different people, they're going to keep tabs on what you say. So my thought is, in some sense, there's a part of this that makes me hope that Beyoncé and others are starting to say, well, we're gonna start speaking up a little bit in a different way. It's a very interesting video. It's a great song.
And
you
know? The song Formation is itself kind of interesting. Dionco London talks about the way in which it's Zandrian, New South Negress.
Yeah,
a great
article.
Great article about how the song is about alignments, the stillness, the readying, the quiet before the twerk, the turn up, the social movement. To be successful, there must be coordination, the kind that choreographers and movement leaders do, the kind that black women organizers do in neighborhoods and organizations. I mean, this itself is just a very lyrical commentary on what that song evokes for her.
And even an article that addresses the line, I've got hot sauce in my bag, was like a revelation. You know, it was great. I loved
and, you
reading
know,
it, and I loved what she put together about that. The simplicity of it being a common experience to have that hot sauce in your bag for these reasons. But she also linked it to the history of Jim Crow and the inability of black people to eat in a restaurant then required them to have utensils, plates, and all you needed to make that meal appropriate for you.
So if you look up hot sauce in my bag, you will see this rich social history. And it also reminded me once again of bell hooks, who describes blacks in popular culture and film culture as just adding spice to the barrenness and emptiness of white culture, that they don't have subjectivity of their own. They're just introduced for spice. And this kind of takes that idea of spice and turns it around, because it, as a, kind of a symbol or a signifier, it also represents something sustaining that we carry with us into the world, that we carry our own spice and our own aliveness. So I think it's also a very rich symbol or signifier of the capacities of black culture and to draw on its own vitality in sustaining itself.
There's a lot to be said too about the controversy around Beyoncé's feminism, which we're not going to have time to really address. But I always kind of
and
go
whether
back
she's
to this.
A feminist or anti-feminist,
right?
Or,
but you know that the choreography and the dancing and the costuming and all of it are actually really spectacular. And in a way, you know, I think she may have been criticized a little bit for drawing from trans women or from drag, but we all sort of draw from each other. But the glamour piece of this that she brings to the forefront, I don't know that we need to lose that. You know, it's like you said, it's part of the spice. Like, women can be powerful sexual beings and create great art and dance and whatever, music, and still be, you know, not victims of patriarchy. Yes, that's a big question.
And I think
question.
part of the criticism is the how much that limits other images, or does that eclipse every other image of beauty or sexuality out there? And that's, I think, always key. It's not banishing these images. It's the narrowness and limitations.
Yeah, do we need to banish that image in order to make the other images powerful because they've been suppressed.
Yeah.
But that we do need to wrap it up, Jen.
I think we've become fans.
I am now. this is Denise Morrison with Jan Hocken, the Old Mole Variety Hour. I think we had a good show this morning. We did a lot. We got some good art and culture in, and some climate change. Bill Resnick and Frank Ackerman.
And the depressive side of our political situation.
And I think from there we'll just call it a day. This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour. Denise Morris, your host. Patricia Kohlberg has been our engineer.
And it is just a few seconds before 10 a.m. Coming up is Chris Andre with Air Cascadia. That will be followed today at 10:15 by Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. She speaks with forest ecologist Dominic Della Sala and Chad Hansen about the vital role that fire plays in promoting healthy forest ecosystems. At 11 on Disability Awareness, Barry Vogel interviews Yale University Medical School professor Dr. Sally Shaywitz, author of Overcoming Dyslexia. And at 11:30 on Voices for Animals, host Dab Stedman talks with Cindy Scheel, the executive director of the PAW PAW team in Portland, about free essential vet care and related services to pets of the homeless and low-income families. Thank you for listening to KBOO, and thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 26th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 5th through March 5th. Most of the films will screen at Portland Community College Cascade Campus, and two films will show at the